Welcome back to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. Killer whales, gaming addiction, and pregnancy discrimination. Some news stories you might have missed over the weekend. And here to tell you more is our Monday news panel. And this time we have Kevin Schofield, writer and editor at SCC Insight, an independent site that reports on the Seattle City Council. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks for having me back.
And Karen Wise, Seattle reporter for Bloomberg Business Week and Bloomberg Technology. Good to see you, Karen.
You too.
Kevin, you brought us a story about our declining local orca population.
Yeah, so it was announced over the weekend that one more of our southern resident orcas has gone missing and is presumed dead. That brings the total down to 75 right now, which is the lowest it's been in 34 years.
This is a 23-year-old male orca nicknamed Cruiser. Hasn't been seen in more than 6 months. And so what does that say? For those who don't follow the orca situation, what do we blame this decline on?
Well, this is sort of death of a thousand cuts. Over the last 70, 80 years, we've done pretty much every awful thing we can possibly do to orcas in Puget Sound. We dumped a bunch of PCBs out there. We dammed up our rivers, decimated the salmon runs, which is what our local orcas feed on. In the late 60s and early 70s, we live captured all the juvenile males out of the southern resident population and sent them to marine parks, which, go figure, they had a hard time reproducing after that.
Mm. And by the way, when we say southern resident, this is relatively southern is
right.
Relative speaking.
Yeah, so,
this is the off the BC and Washington State.
Right. So if you think about Vancouver Island, there's one set of orcas called the northern residents, which hang out around the north end of Vancouver Island. And there's one set called the southern residents that hang around at the south end of Vancouver Island and around the San Juan Islands.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so the last thing that we did is nowadays we follow them around with a whole fleet of whale watching boats.
Yeah. What can our listeners do about that? Never go whale watching?
Well, there's lots of places where you can go whale watching from shore rather mm-hmm. than going out on the boats. But I think, politically, there's some things that we're going to have to just wrestle with long term, like what do we do about all these dams we have on our rivers, which, if we care not just about the orcas, but about salmon population and that whole ecosystem. We've really done some serious damage to rivers in the Pacific Northwest by damming up so much of them. That's a particularly difficult political thorny issue, but it's one we're going to have to face.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court just said Washington State's on the hook to fix a bunch of culverts, those pipes that run underneath roads and make life harder for salmon.
That's right.
So the orca, that's one endangered species. Karen, you're following news of another one.
Yes, the wolves. It's very interesting. It's a similar idea of when you have one species that can affect a whole ecosystem and the whole fall off from when one species kind of rises and falls. And so wolves have been coming back in the U.S. in the past couple decades after their reintroduction in Yellowstone. And there were none in the Northwest for a long time, for decades, after the government also supported essentially poaching of the wolves. And so the big news from late last week is that the U.S. government's considering delisting wolves from the endangered species list across the lower 48. They're currently delisted in eastern Washington, a number of neighboring states, but not in western Washington and elsewhere. Although they are protected in their state law, so there's this kind of mishmash of things. But it's an example of, in general, a population that has been reintroduced, generally seen as successfully, and rebounded. And so there's a regular periodic review that happens that says, should the species still be on the list? And the wolves are up, and the question will be also in this federal administration, how much it's contested science as it is, and obviously this is a moment of very contested science nationally anyway. So it'll be really interesting to watch how that unfolds. In particular, there's people care a lot about wolves in the state. There's conservationists, there's hikers, there's hunters, there's cattle ranchers. So a lot of people have stake in this.
Yeah, basically, if the federal government were to delist across all of Washington state, it would give ranchers and wildlife managers more latitude to kill the wolves that attack livestock?
Potentially, because it relieves some of the responsibility on the state from what the state has to do. The state has its own set of laws as well. And also, it depends as the wolves continue to spread. So far, they've only stayed in eastern Washington. But as they spread, presumably continue to expand their territory, which they have been doing, it'll be a big question of how much protections they'll get then.
I don't know what I would have guessed as far as the number of gray wolves in this area, but it was I would have guessed way more than the reality, which, according to what I read, is about 120 gray wolves in Oregon and Washington.
Well, per state.
Per state, each.
Per state,
so 240-ish.
Yeah.
On another subject, Karen, you flagged a New York Times piece, an investigation that they titled Pregnancy Discrimination is Rampant Inside America's Biggest Companies.
Yeah, what was interesting to me about this story is there are protections against discrimination during pregnancy, and there's questions kind of on the legal edge of that. But some of the examples in this story were just straight out, I mean, they seem to be illegal, just complete violation of the type of protections you have, the type of accommodations for pregnancy, and let alone after, you know, people returning to work.
Did the piece in the New York Times said that there was a quote, many of the country's largest and most prestigious companies still systematically sideline pregnant women. They pass them over for promotions and raises. They fire them when they complain. How surprising was that piece to you?
It's interesting. In some sense, it's shocking when you still to see some things in print and to see things kind of that have gone through a fact-checking process as rigorous as that. In another sense, pregnancy is, you know, pregnancy discrimination is clearly a thing that happens. And I have a toddler. And so I recently was just surprised when I was pregnant about the physicality of the entire pregnancy. I had kind of assumed before, yeah, when you get huge, you're uncomfortable, whatever. But like, no, it was like 10 really physically challenging months, and I had a healthy pregnancy.
Did you feel you were discriminated against in the workplace?
I did not, actually. I had a great accommodation. I had a pumping room once I had a baby. Actually, my pump room was a kind of a closet, but also had a view of the Space Needle, so I felt very lucky in that sense, a fridge to store my milk in. But you talk to people, including people that work at companies that pride themselves in promoting a safe and kind of equal environment, a lot of tech companies, and they still have problems, everything from, you know, debating how much to travel for work in the final days of their pregnancy to having access to pumping facilities at industry conferences. So there are still industry conferences that don't accommodate that at all. So it takes a lot to be supportive.
So one of the issues that comes up around this a lot is that while there are laws in the books which prohibit a lot of these things, oftentimes attorneys don't want to take these cases on because, you know, they may not make any money, even if they win. Right. It may not cover their cost to do this. So
why not?
It just may be the way the law is written. So one of the things that our city council here has done with a lot of the labor laws that they've written is they've written what's called a private right of action, which allows me, if my employer does something, you know, breaks a law, you know, these kinds of labor laws, not only to file a complaint with the city, but to sue directly, in which case an attorney could get, you know, attorney's fees and costs covered, if not, you know, a percentage of, you know, whatever compensation is given back. So there's, you know, more incentive for attorneys to say, hey, all right, I'm, you know, this is not a pro bono thing for me. I'm really willing to take this case and fight for, you know, the good guys in this and make sure we're really enforcing these laws, because it's not just going to be, you know, a bunch of money down the, you know, down the sink for me.
Finally, the World Health Organization recognized a new mental health condition today, gaming disorder. And here's a little description. This is Hillary Cash, a co-founder of an inpatient treatment program for video game addiction here in Fall City. It's called Restart. And she told CNN how gaming addiction affects players.
They do lose control. Their impulse to just go online and game and do whatever else they want to do online, that is stronger than whatever it is they tell themselves they should be doing.
Karen, you've done some reporting on this. What do you think of an official gaming disorder?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's actually kind of controversial in many ways, because there's a question of, is this a distinct thing, or is there a series of addiction, addictive-like behaviors that people have, and it affects how you treat them? Is there something that's unique about gaming versus internet addiction versus smartphone addiction versus gambling addiction? But at the same time, there is more of a body of research around gaming than these other issues. It follows on the footsteps of gambling disorder, which was the first behavioral addictive disorder. Previously, all addictions were more like drug use or some external stimulant that you put in your body.
Here's the reaction from the Entertainment Software Association. Quote, Legitimate science, objective research, and common sense all prove video games are not addictive. By misusing the word addiction, which is a medical term, society demeans real compulsive behaviors like alcoholism and drug abuse, which deserve treatment, compassion, and care. Kevin, what did you think of this?
I think that's a lie. It's just a flat-out lie. And you look at, as Karen was saying, you look at the spectrum across slot machines and gambling addiction and video games and how both, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram are all designed. And the design principles are the same across all of them. They're short, very small activities that immediately give you a reward that's going to trigger the dopamine receptors in your brain. And you get in this feedback loop where you just keep doing it because you keep getting rewarded for doing these small things and you do it forever. You know, I used to work in the software industry. I can, you know, doing user interface design. These are well-known designs.
Were you an addictor? You were designing how to make more addictive games?
I didn't work on the kinds of products that would get people addicted. I worked on far more boring kind of stuff than that. Mm. But these are well-known design principles. You know, there's a reason slot machines are designed the way slot machines are, right? Because that kind of activity, you pull the lever, blip, 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 and something happens, pull the lever, and they know just how often to make sure you get at least a little bit of a win, you know, on one of the pulls in the slot machine to keep you coming back.
Well, what about the fact that you could be a professional gambler or a professional gamer not a professional drinker or a professional smoker? I mean, you can get an e-sports scholarship to a university now. You know, we wouldn't say a basketball star has a disorder. We'd say, what a hard worker.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are different classes of these things, right? There are certainly games which are less addictive. And we should be careful, you know, to that point, not to broad brush all video games and say they are all addictive, right? That's certainly not true, right?
But the poorly designed ones are not addictive?
Well, you know, I think the designers would tell you that they're not poorly designed. I think, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has said some things recently about the design of Facebook. To say, hey, all companies, when they're designing, you know, software, whether it's Facebook or, you know, Microsoft Word or what other kinds of programs they are designing for you, they want to maximize the amount of time you're using it, right? That is their job, because they make more money if you feel that piece of software is more valuable to you. You're going to pay more for it. You're going to spend more time with it and less time with your, you know, competitors' products. And so they really want to maximize the amount of time that you spend with their product. And they're going to use whatever design principles they have to do that.
Karen, is an addiction to a building game like Minecraft the same as an addiction to a fighting game or a sports game?
You know, I actually am not a gamer, so I'm probably the wrong person to ask this question to. But one thing that did strike me when I was interviewing researchers in this field was that they said that, you know, most people can play games and not be addicted. And that's not everyone has the disorder, not every game, or not everyone is predisposition to be addicted to something. And so I forget the exact percentages, but it was certainly somewhere in the neighborhood of 5% or fewer of users might be addicted. And I believe it was actually even smaller than that. And the interesting thing when you're trying to define in a kind of technical terms a disorder is it has to be prevalent enough to have some meaning and some unique characteristics. But if it's so broad, it's probably not actually a good description of something too. So the folks, researchers I were talking with, were trying to caution that, yes, this can be a thing, but it's not like no one should play a game ever, or yeah, no one should make games ever. And there are these something like 2/3 of Americans regularly play games. It's a huge number. I mean, the esports numbers are staggering. If you've ever been to one of those events where people are cheering, it's pretty cool. So it is complicated and it is relatively new research, because gaming as we know it is a relatively new phenomenon. It's only really been developed in a home in the past 2 decades.
We're talking about the World Health Organization recognizing a mental health condition called gaming disorder. Covering some of the stories you might have missed over a warm Father's Day weekend, Karen Wise, Seattle reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek and Bloomberg Technology. Kevin Schofield, writer-editor at SCC Insight, reporting on the Seattle City Council. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.